Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is artist Minna Resnick. Resnick is a graduate of the San Francisco Art Institute. Her figurative drawings and prints have been shown nationally and internationally in over 50 public and private collections, including the Brooklyn Museum, the American Council on Education in Washington, D.C., the Denver Art Museum, the Johnson Museum at Cornell University, and the Victoria and Albert Museum in London. She has been the recipient of numerous fellowships, including one from the National Endowment for the Arts. She teaches part-time in the art department at Ithaca College. And welcome to the show, Minna.
Thanks for inviting me.
Now, tell us about your beginnings as an artist. Did you come from an artistic family? How did you get into this profession?
I always did art, even in grade school, apparently. My parents always encouraged it. Nobody in my family ever did art, per se, but I think my father was very handy, as well as my mother. But they've always been a backer of my interest in it and have saved newspaper little clippings that I found a long time ago from grade school about winning poster.
Oh, nice.
And things like that. Uh-huh. So when I decided to go to art school as an undergraduate, they were all for it. I never had any problem. I never thought anything differently.
So you knew from the beginning you were going to be an artist, and you have pursued that and been successful. That's amazing.
Oh, amazing or not, I guess that's what path I took.
Uh-huh. And did you always want to do printmaking? Did you start as oils or anything?
I went to Bayside High School, which at that time and possibly still now has an incredibly good reputation. It's outside of music and art and the specialty schools in New York City. As a public school, Bayside had the strongest art department, and they had majors there in the art department. I majored in graphic design. And then when I got to college, I majored in graphic design also with a minor in printmaking. I liked getting my hands dirty, and I also missed drawing, just keeping up with the drawing. From college, actually, I intended to go to get a master's right away, and I was accepted in a master's program in printmaking. I decided to change. But unsolicited, through a faculty member, I got a job for the New York City Parks and Recreation Department as their only graphic designer.
Wow.
And to have an opportunity like that at the beginning, where you don't have to work for someone else and this and that, was great. And it was a phenomenal beginning to a short graphic design career.
Uh-huh.
But I got to do tour systems throughout the boroughs. My office was in the middle of Central Park Zoo.
Wow.
It was a heady time. Mayor Lindsay was mayor. Elliot Walensky was my boss. We did a lot. It was very exciting times.
Wow, and what a place to do what you might call an internship, you know?
That's
amazing.
Absolutely.
Well, I want to talk to you about much of your work seems to stem from the past.
Mm.
You do a lot of 50s, early 20th century kind of graphics. Tell us why you're influenced by the past.
Well, it didn't start out like that. Because I was in graphic design and we moved around and I did some advertising, I did postpone my master's in printmaking, and when I left advertising for good and decided to go back into printmaking, I really had to figure out what I wanted to do. So I started drawing from people I knew, isolating them in sort of a stage setting and thinking about identity, internal ideas and external expectations. And I did that for many years, and that sort of evolved really into a more complicated situation. I started using some sources from appropriated material from the mid-20th century books, and I wanted to broaden out this inside-outside view of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that happened probably in the early 90s, I was using books that teach language because I was really interested. I went from body language to sort of language as communication, although body language is certainly communication also.
Mm-hmm.
One of the images I had was diagrams for children to learn sounds. In particular, this one was a V sound. I was taking the diagram and putting a word in that was definitely not appropriate for grade school. The word I substituted was voluptuous because I was using sexual ideas versus work ideas. And the symbol for this was an old trolley with a grate on the front. And so many people didn't understand what that visual for the sound was. It's the V sound, and it was actually a grate that was supposed to scrape manure away from the horses on the old trolleys. And my daughter at this point was actually becoming a young woman, and I just started thinking about language as a generational process and how what was common in one era for learning language and communicating disappeared or evolved over time and was lost to future generations. So I sort of broadened out my emphasis on, rather than the personal, then to a much broader and longer time frame.
Oh, interesting. So in other words, you're trying to show people how people developed as human beings by what they were susceptible to in the past in regard to culture? Is that what you...
Well, I mean, culture always affects language, but I think, especially for my generation, the last dozen years or so with all this electronic media and
high-tech
stuff, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, texting now is its own language, and since I don't text, you know, all those shortcuts, there's a whole language out there that I can see that I don't understand.
Uh-huh.
And I think it's accelerated, and a lot of the images I do, on occasion, I just feel overwhelmed by technology, and information overload, because mm-hmm. information is so accessible.
Mm-hmm.
And my information is always visual. So a lot of the images I do build on layers. It's a printmaker's way of thinking, even though I'm doing prints and drawings now. And I choose whether that layer is easy to see or difficult to see. So a lot of times my images are loaded up with information that you really have to strain to separate.
I think it's fascinating. I found some of your prints almost disorienting because I couldn't tell if I was supposed to be looking at something from 1930 and then you were bringing it into the now, which you also do.
Well, I think by taking different images from different eras, you remix the narrative. And then it assigns new meaning and new relationships to all those images. And hopefully I do this while sort of keeping a sense of humor about it.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. A lot of your stuff seems whimsical. Okay. I love that. I love that. Now, you had a set of prints that particularly affected me. And it was the ones called Secret Places, where ghost-like. Tell us about that whole series, because it reminded me of death at first, and then I thought spirits, and then you were calling them secret places.
Yeah. That's actually from the mid-80s, so it's a long time ago. And that project actually was quite a wonderful project for me. During that time, I was really still involved in using women that I knew for models and trying to set up poses that would be ordinary poses, but put them into a world that was very ambiguous.
Mm-hmm.
And that particular series also was, I think, very internalized and mysterious. And my older work was, I think, much more mysterious than it is now. And so in that particular one, I actually collaborated with I was living in Fort Collins, Colorado at the time, and collaborated with a photographer who lived there, Joe Coca. We were friends, and I liked his work. And I went to him, and I said, you know, I don't do the photo stuff. Could we get together? I have an idea. Could you photograph it and then supply me with some photos that we agree on, and then I will manipulate the photos and go to a local printer who was willing to lose money and take a chance on doing an artist for fun. And so that's how it evolved. Those are offset lithographs in a larger edition than I would hand print. I have a lithographic press at home, and so hand printing editions usually stay to about 25 or less. And these were, you blink and there's 50 printed already on a high
speed
press.
Wow, but they're beautiful.
Well,
they really are gorgeous. I was really taken by those. Now you seem to superimpose one image over another image, and those are the things that seem like they're from different worlds. And so what are you trying to say? Are you trying to meld the past with the present?
I'm not sure melding's the right word, but I'm trying to maybe shake up interpretations of what the past, the present would be, and hopefully change the what was typically associated with those images, change them by putting something new there to reinterpret what you see. And it's always open-ended as to what somebody sees in them, mm-hmm. even though I probably have my own story.
And how do you know when something's finished? Because you seem to have so many layers on it.
Good question. I am not a spontaneous person, so I everything I do is sketched out first.
So it's deliberate?
So it's very deliberate. And I'm very slow at my craft. So I consider myself the tortoise, the slow and steady person. My work always comes from an incredibly strong conceptual place. And now, working with appropriated material, what appeals to me and many times creates the image is the text that comes with the appropriation. And then the text just seems so absurd to me that I make other associations and try to grab images from different eras to pronounce that silliness, maybe.
your drawings seem incredibly intimate. And a lot of your prints seem very intimate. Uh-huh. It's like you're trying to show us someplace where we don't really want to look sometimes. Mm. So tell us about that. Are you trying to unveil and get people to open their minds, perhaps?
Well, certainly one would like to do that. For the first 20 years of my professional life, when I went back to image making after a graphic design career, I was in California, and I became very close with another student, actually a whole group of students, and she actually became my main model for 25 years.
Mm.
And I've always found it, my initial base was, since I take so long in drawing, it meant so much to me to know who I was drawing. And I've been lucky enough to go abroad many times since my husband's had academic opportunities. And the first thing when I went, I would pack this pile of photographs because I couldn't ask this person to stay around for 3, 4, 5 days, and, you know, while I was drawing. So we took photographs. She used them and I used them, and it was sort of a happy arrangement.
Uh-huh. And does your model have any kind of say on how she's interpreted? Does
no.
it matter?
She doesn't.
No way.
But I mean, I stopped really using a lot. I mean, if I do use somebody as a model, I still use those old photographs. And I never. They were always source material. I would take tops and bottoms or arms, you know, and just use them almost for body parts. But somebody had mentioned along the way that inadvertently I had collected an archive of a woman aging, which I thought was actually quite nice, and also feeded this idea of generational information changing. Uh-huh.
You know, let's go back to some of your current drawings are more whimsical than some of your other ones. The other ones, I mean, the earlier ones do seem more serious.
Yeah, and introverted in a way.
Yeah. So the whimsical ones, is you,
well, you get older,
feeling lighter about the world?
Yeah,
perhaps?
Well, I'm not sure I feel lighter about the world. Maybe this is my escape from not feeling lighter about the world.
I
think as you get older, you just come to terms with a lot of things that, when you were younger, aggravated you more. And also, there was a big shift from drawing things that were very internal and cerebral and sort of quiet and certainly introspective. And mm-hmm. and once I decided that I had to get out of that and open up to relate to the world and look around and note those changes, that's when I started appropriating material.
If you're just joining me, my guest is Minna Resnick. She's an artist. We're talking about some of her fascinating prints. I want to talk to you about the series called Craft Disasters. That's a more recent one. And it's from 2008. House fires, drownings, where did that come from?
Oh, that, I hope I don't upset too many people, but I've done art my whole life. And as much as I love these craft stores, I am the worst crafter ever. I don't have the patience for 1 second of doing anything like that. And you enter these places that are full of materials I have no idea how to use. And
so you're talking about arts and crafts stores?
Michael's or AC.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah.
Just a whole explosion. And crafting is a multi-billion dollar
business. Oh, it is. The scrapbooking and all those things.
And I just, that doesn't interest me at all. Maybe because my full-time job is to be what I consider a serious artist, and I don't have any extracurricular time is spent doing other things.
Uh-huh.
So
craft disasters.
Right.
Tell us.
So the whole point of crafting, some of these books, when I start looking through them for material, there were two books in particular that had these fabulous illustrations. They were from the 40s and 50s of disasters. And then I learned that these 12-inch square pieces of paper that they do sell at these stores are actually archival.
Oh.
You know, as serious artists would need. And I thought, this is perfect. I will pick. It's 7 in the series. They're primary, secondary colors in black. And I had my images, and I specifically looked for paper that would be fun, you know, or a good foil for this terrible disaster. So that's why it's called Craft Disasters, because I'm a disaster at crafting. But it's obviously a whole pun on the whole thing.
When I first saw that, I thought, my God, she's just going to have scenes of boats, you know, those craft, those speed boats.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Thinking.
Exactly. You know what I have to ask you, too, because she's been in the news lately. Are you influenced by Cindy Sherman? I mean, her work.
Not at all. I mean, I love Cindy Sherman.
I do too. But your work seems to be modern and trying to tell us something about women, and about yourself.
Yeah, I never made that association, and I certainly never looked to her as a resource.
I was thinking that you might have been influenced by her.
No, not
maybe
at
it's
all.
Just in the air.
It could be that or, kind you of know, thing. Where I'm probably a little older than she is, but maybe we just dealt with general, you know, issues grow, you know, as we aged.
Yeah, but it's this manipulating images and
sure.
and trying to have people see the mundane in a different way or the everyday.
Well, it's
in
a great compliment
way.
That you associate my work with.
Well, it brings me to this 2004 series you called mm-hmm. Applying the Language, where you have this model streaming through all of these creations.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that. Were you commenting on the way women are portrayed in our culture? It seems
because
they were models, right?
Yeah. My personal model and I were both getting older, and when I thought about breaking out from that very internalized point of view, I needed some other source material. And I'm absolutely appalled at some of the representations in fashion magazines and elsewhere about the presentation of how women should look.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Also, as my daughter got older and, I grew up in the women's movement in the 60s, and I figured by the time my daughter was in her 30s, you know, all these body issues would be gone, and they're certainly not gone, and they're in fact renewed.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And so I started using that material, which I thought was just over the top, and try to relate that. And in particular, that series came about because I was interested in wallpaper, specifically toile wallpaper, which also sort of romanticizes domestic history.
So tell us what toile wallpaper is.
Toile wallpaper started in France and England, I'm not sure which, probably in the 18th century. And they're idyllic scenes of domestic bliss, you know, women washing and things like that. And there's a little repeated pattern, and it was very popular in France and England. It came over to the States later, and I just think this stuff's a hoot because there's nothing romantic about house chores. And so
that's the only way women agreed to get into this.
Yeah.
They had to romanticize it.
Yeah.
Look how happy you'll be in this incredible setting. Yeah.
And I think, you know, part of the ads after World War II, when all these ads about how easy things are going to be made, you know, new washing machines and new inventions and things like that. And I just find it funny now. So
I remember when TV dinners came in. I mean, your art reminds me of some of those times when, you know, and to me it was all such lies. And I feel like you're exposing it.
Yeah, well, hopefully I am. I mean, I'm exposing the absurdity of it to me anyhow.
Yeah, but that generic model running through that, applying the language is really interesting to me.
Well, that was actually a wonderful collaboration. I'm mostly in my studio and I'm slow and steady, and you on occasion can feel like a monk. You know, I'm very focused, and that's not the problem. But through many different
processes
and also accidents, I ended up in Switzerland collaborating with a printer. And this was our first collaboration. And so I needed sort of an umbrella of a theme to think about to work with him for a while, since, as I mentioned before, I'm not spontaneous at all. I work well with strong guidelines. And so I found this book called, I forgot what my title was, because it was a while ago.
Applying the Language?
Applying the Language.
Yeah.
And what the language was applying actually was to wallpaper.
Oh.
And I took each chapter heading, and it was about a color and an emotional response to a color. And so that was the first time that I used these models from magazines to my printer called them bimbos. He hated them, actually. but to reference, you know, the sexual versus the the household ordinary, you know, what ordinary women are and the sexualized version of them are. Mm-hmm. And I put them under an umbrella of actually color coding, like red is passion, there's orange, yellow is something else, green is soothing. And so that was my attempt at being a little bit more spontaneous by just pulling in images and coordinating them by color.
Why haven't you gotten into photography? You strike me as somebody who would have a real eye for being able to capture the images that you, in fact, put on your prints.
Yeah, I guess it's never appealed to me. I mean, I had photography in undergraduate school, and, you know, I was in the darkroom for years and years. Mm-hmm. And
but you wouldn't want to have that control of the images.
I think I
like
the interpretation of drawing what I see rather than photographing it.
Uh-huh. That makes sense to me. You can get into more of a depth, more of the emotion.
Yeah, and I can change things. You know, I can see a photograph. I can reference a photograph, but then I have the ability to change it how I want.
Mm-hmm.
So that's I've always enjoyed drawing, and I think the lack of drawing really upsets me. So the fact that I draw in my drawings and prints is sort of a it's just part of who I am.
Well, art, I mean, drawing is still one of the basics that people need to learn in order to be an artist. Don't you agree? Is it not being taught now?
Oh, no, it's certainly being taught. Oh, okay. I teach it at Ithaca College.
You teach drawing, huh?
Yeah. No,
because you just said people aren't doing it anymore.
Well, maybe that's not true then. I mean, certainly people are doing it. I have to do it.
Yeah.
It's really important to
almost me. Every artist I've ever talked to, whether they paint or, you know, do abstracts, drawing is the basis.
Well, I think the reason drawing is so important, even to somebody who doesn't want to have an art career, is it's a critical thinking and a critical eye. You have to learn to essentially draw what you see and not draw what you think you are seeing. There's a big divide, and training the brain to do that, I think, is a very valuable lesson, whether you're an artist or a scientist or a writer. I think it's very helpful.
It teaches you how to see, which you need for almost everything in life.
And critically, how to evaluate things. Yeah.
How do you feel about the place of women in art now? You know, through the years, I've always heard that women are still not valued in art. Their art doesn't sell for as much. Well, what is your take on the place of women in art at this point? Have they made strides? Have you made strides?
Well, they probably have made strides. I actually usually never get into discussions, try not to get into discussions like that, because in a way they're futile for me. It is what it is. I think what you said is correct. I think women are paid less. It's harder to get into
especially the big scenes,
I think actually what I've experienced, and I'm hoping it's not correct and it's just a personal response, is that I think ageism is crawling into it, and that people have seen my work and somehow I thought that me being older was a disadvantage rather than just being female.
Really?
And older is even worse than being female. But that might just be my perception, and hopefully that's not true.
Well, I mean, that permeates the culture, so I imagine that probably is true.
Well, aging in the culture is probably not respected by and large, although there are many, many articles coming out that do encourage, you know.
And we do revere some of the artists that were painting, you know, like Georgia O'Keeffe, and, you know, some of her late work is still totally thought of as having a major place in the art world. In 2007 and 2009, you organized an international printmaking exhibition in China. Tell us about that. What was that like?
Oh, that was extraordinary. And again, it came about sort of serendipitously in terms of my connections for managing that. I was teaching part-time at SUNY Cortland for many years. The ceramics department had an ongoing relationship with a Chinese artist, Jensen Lee, known as Jackson in the States. And I had wanted to go. They had students going on trips every summer, experiencing making ceramics in his studio. He has a residency in China. So we shared an office at one point. He was here for 6 weeks, and I kept on saying, well, I'm coming, but it can't be until such and such a summer. And Jackson said to me, well, don't come for ceramics. Why don't you organize a printmaking exhibition, and everybody can come. You'll be there for a month, and you can spend a week at my ceramics residency. You can send drawings that we would make into decals, and then you can apply those decals to porcelain.
Oh.
And we can visit papermaking villages and all these things, and also organize an exhibition in China and visit universities and get to know printmaking colleagues throughout China. So that happened first in 2007 and again in 2009 with completely different exhibitions, and then actually two completely different groups of people.
Is printmaking really big in China still?
Yes, but different kinds. I mean, their history is woodcut.
Oh, yes.
Of which they're extraordinary at. And the facilities of most of the schools we visited on each occasion were quite extensive, and it is a popular and strong discipline there.
Hmm. Before we run out of time, I do want to talk to you more about teaching.
Okay.
To tell us what you try to inspire in students as aspiring artists.
That's a good question. I think when I teach any class, I hope to inspire critical thinking, doing a job well, seeing through the hard parts of making art. And since I'm pretty disciplined myself, I hope to instill some strong discipline in my students.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you should interview some students and see how they respond. I'm not sure.
Well, I think it would be valuable just to have a working artist as a teacher, you know?
Yeah, but I think most university art departments do have working artists.
And you have to be a working artist.
Yeah, I think that's part and parcel of your academic background.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Are you upset about the fact that art is being taught less and less, especially in the early grades?
Yeah,
like
I think
it's not
budget cuts are.
It's really upsetting.
It is.
So many of us.
Our daughter was in a school in primary school in Colorado, and it was an alternative school, I guess. And right away, when they had a science project, before they even started evaluating the science, they would draw what they saw. And through the drawing, then, they would figure out what the experiment was about.
Oh, that's great.
And I just think this whole idea of looking carefully is so important to everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the arts are probably minimalized due to budget cuts and things like that.
Oh, absolutely. But we forget how important it is for a well-rounded human being, is what I think.
Correct.
Well, Minna, we are almost out of time. Do you have any contact information that people can come look at your website or prints?
Yes, thank you. I have a website. It's minnaresnick.com. Unfortunately, it's being updated as we speak, so probably hasn't had new work on it for about almost 2 years. And I have done a lot in the past 2 years, so hopefully that'll be on there soon.
That's great. Well, Minna Resnick, thank you so much for joining us. It's been
a
great pleasure talking about your wonderful work.
Thanks for asking me.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.